Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Today is Friday, March 1st, 2024. Let the record reflect the time is 4:17 p.m. Today we have present Representative Sadler, Representative Prox, Representative Carrick, and myself, Chair Sumner. The staff will be assisting us today are Kevin Allen with House Records, Zachary Lawhorn with the LIO, and Serena Hackenmiller, my staff and committee aide to House Labor and Commerce. Today in committee, we have two bills to hear. We were going to hear Executive Order 127 and 130, but because of time constraints, I decided to wait until next week when we have more time to hear the Senate joint resolutions that relate to the same topic. We're going to roll House Bill 203 to Monday, where we will have invited and public testimony. We're going to hear House Bill 262 from Representative Josephson. So if Representative Josephson's staff could please approach the committee, put their name on the record, and begin.
For the record, my name is Lisa Keller, staff to Representative Andy Josephson. And apologies, Representative Josephson is in a finance subcommittee closeout right now. So I am flying solo for my first bill hearing. I'm very excited. Good afternoon, Chair Sumner and members of the Labor and Commerce Committee. Through the chair, if you would like, I will describe the bill and why we need this legislation.
Sure.
Alaska currently does not have a statute regarding notice of rent increase. A 30-day notice of end of tenancy is required, and this is seen as an end to the current contract. A landlord can then raise the rent on a new monthly contract. In practice, and documented in the Landlord-Tenant Act, the requirement is a 30-day notice of rent increase. Again, this is not in statute. This bill would put a rent increase notice of 90 days in statute as long as the tenant is current in rent. We know that a significant portion of our community is cost burdened, spending over 30% and even over 50% of their income on housing. This spans all renter households, even those making $75,000 and over. 61% of homeless people are not chronically homeless. They are in the labor force, in school, they're caregivers, and they're seniors. They're living paycheck to paycheck, a rent increase away from losing their housing. There is a connection between a rent increase and the chance of becoming homeless. For every $100 increase in rent, there's a 9% increase in the risk of becoming homeless. Rent costs in Alaska on a two-bedroom apartment increased on average 7% between 2022 and 2023. Once again, this bill puts the notice of rent increase in statute and set that notification at 90 days, as long as the tenant's rent is current. This bill gives people more time to come up with income to support the higher rent, find new, more affordable housing, or to find a roommate. Through the chair, if you'd like, I'll begin the sectional analysis.
Yeah, go ahead. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Section 1 amends AS 3403020 by adding a new subsection that requires a landlord to give at least a 90-day notice before increasing rent on a dwelling unit for which the rent is current. The notice to the tenant who is current in rent serves as the start line for the rent increase. If the tenant moves out before 90 days, the rent cannot be raised for the subsequent tenant until after the increase specified in the original notice. If notice has not been given to the tenant, the rent cannot be raised on the unit until 90 days after the date of the tenant's rental agreement termination. Section 2 amends the uncodified law of the state of Alaska by adding a new section regarding applicability to a rental agreement entered on or after the effective date. Section 3 sets an immediate effective date. This is the end of the sectional. Through chair, if you would like, I would begin the presentation.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. These are the details of HB 262. When rent is current, HB 262 requires landlords to give tenants 90 days notice of a rent increase on a month-to-month tenancy. So, for example, on January 1st, notice is given. That means on April 1st, the rent can increase. The next piece is, if a tenant chooses to end the tenancy 30 days after the notice, the landlord must abide by the original notice of rent increase date. So on January 1st, the notice is given. On February 1st, the tenant moves out. The rent on the new tenant cannot increase until April 1st. If rent increase notice has not been given to a tenant and the tenant is given a notice to vacate for any reason, the rent cannot be raised until 90 days after the date of the rental agreement termination. So on January 1st, the landlord gives the tenants notice to vacate on January 31st without giving a date for a rental increase. The rent on the unit then for subsequent renters cannot be raised until May 1st. This would close a loophole that would potentially allow the landlord to give notice to vacate in order to raise the rent sooner on the next tenant. So they move one tenant out, they can then raise the rent on the next tenant sooner. HB 262 gives renters more time to budget for a rent increase, find more affordable housing, or find roommates to share the cost. It's very important to note that AS 3403-220B still applies to unpaid rent, even if a 90-day notice of rent increase has been given to the tenant. So this HB 262 makes no changes to this part of the law. The statute says that if rent is not paid when due, the landlord may give written notice of intent to terminate. The tenant then has 7 days to pay the past due rent. If the tenant does not pay the rent due within 7 days, the landlord may terminate the rental agreement and immediately regain the unit. As I said before, there's nothing in current statute that requires a notification of rent increase right now. Rent increase is addressed in the Alaska Landlord and Tenant Act, published by the Department of Law. This document is inconsistent with the actual law. This is what it states, these next points. Must, quote, give adequate notice of a rent increase. That's on page 11. It's not in statute, and adequate is not defined. Unless there's a lease, the landlord is legally entitled to raise the rent by any amount, must give the tenant at least 30 days before the increase takes effect. Although we have a date here, 30 days, this is on page 17 and is not in statute. The third point is, legally, a notice of rent increase is probably equivalent to a termination of the rental agreement at the old rate and an offer to rent the same unit at a higher rent. This is on page 17. Again, not in statute, but this is how it's been interpreted. Before we talk about rental increases, one of the important things to understand is the cost burden that is on households right now. And many of us have heard this before throughout our life, that affordable housing is defined as housing and associated fees and utilities that cost no more than 30% of gross income. A cost burden household spends more than 30% of gross income on housing costs, and a severely cost burden household spends more than 50% of gross income on housing costs. Cost burden has increased across all incomes. And this chart shows you that when you have the lower incomes, if you're making under $30,000, you can see that there is quite a severe cost burden, meaning those folks have over 50% of their income they're spending on rent and associated cost. And as we go up in income, so 30 to 44,999, that you have less severely cost burden folks, but you have a lot of moderately cost burden folks. And you can see that's like inching up into like 70%. And then, and you can also see as the years have gone by, this has gotten worse. Then in that next group, the numbers go down, not as many of percentage are cost burden or severely cost burden, but there is a significant number who are still moderately cost burden. And then the kind of surprising to us was that 75,000 and over, that income group, very small sliver in 2022 was actually severely cost burden, but there's still significant up to 10% that are moderately cost burden. This slide shows a study from the Pew Charitable Trust that was released in 2023. And it was developed using homelessness data from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. What you'll notice here is that on the left-hand part of the slide, you see a percent change in the median rent from 2017 to 2022. And you see these six cities that are quite high. They've changed their median rent. It's gone up quite high. Sacramento, Fresno, Raleigh, Phoenix, Austin, and Tucson. And on the right part of the slide, you can see how homelessness has increased in those areas where the rent has soared. So Sacramento, 144% increase in homelessness over those years. But all of them increased quite a bit. The median, or the United States, if you look at the whole United States, the change in median rent was 26% over those years. Homelessness increased by 4%. However, it's very regional. At the bottom of the slide, you can see even these four cities, Minneapolis, Houston, Philadelphia, and Chicago, had a change in median rent. They did show a decrease in homelessness, even though their median rent went up. But they also had many other programs that were working on their homeless program, and it is multifaceted. This is just one piece of it. In Alaska, cost burden renters have hit an all-time high in the year 2022. This is from the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. It was Alaska Economic Trends that were released September 2023. And the two reasons are that, number one, rent has increased, inflation has increased to the highest rate in decades, and demand is high and supply is low. Vacancy rates also remain low in Alaska, and that's multifaceted. Out-migration, although we still have out-migration, it has slowed. Homes have become less affordable. Home building has been low in recent years, and there are more short-term rentals. This is the Alaska housing cost burden, and these statistics are from the National Low Income Housing Coalition specific to Alaska. And the numbers, there's a lot going on in the slide. The numbers I'd like you to look, to really recognize are on the top part of the slide, 24% of renter households are extremely low income. So that's a quarter of all renter income households are low income, extremely low income. On the right-hand part of the slide, 69% of extremely low-income renter households have a severe cost burden. Those people are spending more than 50% of their income on housing. And then that minus 13,000 plus figure, that's the shortage of just over 13,000 rental homes that are affordable to extremely low-income renters. So the housing is not out there either. $33,130 is the maximum income for a four-person, extremely low-income household, yet $54,740 is needed to afford a two-bedroom rental home in Alaska. Then in the very middle bar graph there at the bottom, you can see as income goes up, renters have more options in housing. So if you're extremely low-income, there are only 35 affordable and available homes for every 100 renters. On the other end, if you are at 100% of area median income, there are 103 affordable and available homes per 100 renter households. The bar graph on the right shows that even 28% of middle-income households are cost-burdened, spending more than 30% of their income on housing and associated costs. And then on the left, when we look at the pie chart, the makeup of extremely low-income renter households in the pie chart on the left, we can see that 30% of the households are in the labor force, 30% are disabled, and 17% are seniors. And these are truly some of our most vulnerable neighbors. This slide shows a connection between rent increase and homelessness with some different numbers here. The number that I mentioned earlier in the opening was that 61% of unhoused people are not chronically homeless. These are people who are one paycheck away from losing their home. They're just really living on the edge. In Alaska, again from that report from the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development, between 2022 and 2023, there was a 7% increase in average rent on two-bedroom apartments. The lowest increase was in Sitka at 3%, and the highest was in Ketchikan at 16%. And there's a couple of kind of key pieces to remember from the U.S. Government Accountability Office. A $100 increase in median rent is associated with a 9% increase in estimated homelessness rate. And at the very top, the share of income people spend on rent increases. If it increases by 2 percentage points, 4 more people are predicted to experience homelessness. So these are truly people that are living on the edge. These are the states with a more than 30-day notice of rent increase, and this is a movement happening right now. You can see that there's a couple states in there. Oregon recently passed 90 days. Vermont recently passed 60 days. So there are states that are moving towards a longer period of notice to renters on a rent increase. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is the end of my presentation. Any questions?
Representative Ruffridge?
Thank you, Chair Sumner. Through the chair, appreciate the presentation and the bill. I guess the biggest question that I have, because I certainly understand the correlation between rent increases and homelessness, if the time frame for rent increases increased in 90 days, in other states that have implemented programs that are similar, have people been able to find alternative housing in those windows? Because the concern would be that rents are raising sort of ubiquitously, and so even if you get priced out of the place where you're in currently, regardless of whether you're noticed or not, maybe you can't afford an alternative location. So it does notices actually drive down houseless or homeless persons, and are they able to find a new place to stay?
I have not seen a study about that. I can definitely look into it and get back to you on that, though.
Okay.
However, we do know that there's a shortage, and a lot of communities are dealing with that by having short-term rental legislation, because that is taking some available housing off of the market. I know another piece of this in the past was that there used to be short-term rentals that were basically like studios that people, I mean, we're talking 30, 40 years ago, that people could rent on a short-term basis, maybe weekly, definitely monthly. And a lot of those old buildings, because it really kind of goes back to the 1930s, 40s, 50s, a lot of those buildings have been, you know, basically taken down to build apartment buildings, which are more expensive. So there has been this move, this movement over the last 30 years to take these affordable units off the market to build something bigger that's less affordable to a lot of people.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, a comment and a question. I can certainly understand the impetus, the benefit of giving a 90-day notice of a rent increase to any one given tenant. But the paragraph 1 on page 1, lines 10 through 13, my question would be, why should a subsequent tenant's lease, conditions on that lease, be binding any subsequent tenant lease? In other words, if someone moves out for whatever reason, then the rent cannot be raised on a subsequent tenant until after the expiration of the previous 90-day notice. That just seems like holding one person responsible for conditions imposed on a previous person. What's the justification for that?
We talked about this with legal, and part of the justification from it is that this is a rent stabilization bill, not a rent control bill, but a rent stabilization. So that, in a sense, the rent is following the unit, and they felt that that would be the drafter felt that that would be an effective way to stabilize rent for future tenants. And through the chair, that might not be a satisfactory answer, and I can revisit that with the drafter to remind myself of why they did that.
Follow up. Thank you for that. Through the chair, so there seems to be, most of your presentation and the sponsor statement, et cetera, seems to be coming from the tenant's point of view, and I understand the desire to make not to make people homeless, but there is, on the other side of that equation, the property owner, who is the other party to the lease. Is there any consideration of how this rent stabilization bill would affect the willingness of a property owner to invest in providing housing if the price is depressed, you know, or stabilized.
Yeah. Through the chair. I think the key piece that we wanted to make sure that landlords were covered was that the rent has to be current with the tenant in order to get this 90 days. So if the rent isn't current, then the landlord can move on removing them from the unit. And likewise, if the rent is current on January 1st and they give them the notice on February 1st, if that rent is not current, then the landlord can move on them. Again, I'm not sure if that adequately answered your question.
Yeah. A quick short follow-up just to clarify.
Yeah,
so the rent must be current throughout that 90-day notice period, right?
Yes, yeah. Okay. It has to stay current during the whole 90 days.
Good. Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else?
No.
Oh, Representative Cross.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, you have done some studies on the effect on tenants. Have you talked to property managers or apartment building owners or somebody like that to figure out why their costs are increasing, and I suppose real estate companies to figure out why more housing isn't becoming available?
Through the chair, we did not talk to any big property owners about the problem. I personally did talk to people I know who are property owners and landlords, and found none of them actually opposed to it. They did feel it would take a little bit more planning on their part, you know, if they want to raise the rent. But I think the rent cost going up again, I think back to a couple slides back, has to do with inflation. So the price of everything for landlords is going up. It has to do with short-term rentals. So there are units being taken off the market so that there just aren't as many units out there. And I think especially on the lower income range where people are looking for affordable housing so that they're not spending this over 30 or over 50% of their income, it's really difficult to find a unit that you can afford anymore. So people are doubling up, and there's a term, I can't remember exactly what it is. I think it's like unhoused homeless, which are temporary unhoused. I wish I could remember that, but it's basically where people are like living with family. So they have a roof over their head, but they don't really have a place of their own.
Representative Carrick.
Thanks through the chair. And I think I just found it in the bill in line 7 and 8, where it says upon termination, either by a landlord or by the expiration of the term. And so I guess the question related to that is if you had a year long lease and the landlord wanted to raise the rent beginning at the start of the renewal of that lease, for a new year-long lease, would a 90-day notice requirement for a raise in rent price apply in that period? Or are we just talking about mid-lease raises? And I think we talked about this at one point, but just if you could answer it on the record too.
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, we did talk about this, and we do see a potential for some change to the bill to address that issue, because the drafter, when he drafted this, said that it applies to month-to-month only, not to leases.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Anybody else? Oh, Representative Frost.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair. In Fairbanks, currently, for instance, the price of energy, be that electricity or heating fuel or whatever, is fairly volatile. If the price of utilities, shall we say, is included in the rent and those go up, then the property owner cannot pass that along to the tenant. and that seems a little bit unfair. Should we be imposing some sort of price stability on utilities and heating oil companies as well?
Through the chair, Representative Prox. I've rented a lot throughout my life. Sometimes the utilities have been included in the rent, and sometimes they haven't. But when you're talking about being cost-burdened or extremely cost-burdened, it does include those two things, both rent and your utilities. This bill only deals with the rent portion, so I would say what the landlord chooses to do is something totally different. If they want to separate those out so they don't have to deal with any price changes in utilities, that would be to their discretion.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, looks like we have invited testimony. I've got Owen Hutchinson. Why don't you put your name on the record and begin your testimony?
Thank you, Chair Sumner. For the record, my name is Owen Hutchinson, and I am the Housing and Healthcare Integration Manager for the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness. We are a 501c3 serving the Alaska Balance of State HUD Continuum of Care. There's two in Alaska, one in Anchorage, and one for the remainder of the state. Our membership includes homeless service providers, people with lived experience, and housing advocates from all over. We also manage the Alaska Homeless Management Information System, which tracks client-level data that is entered by service providers. I think there's 42 grantees from HUD across the state that are co-managed between us and the Anchorage Coalition. We support HB 262 and tenant protections. That slide that Lisa shared from the National Low Income Housing Coalition, that is data that came from the U.S. Census Bureau 2021 American Community Survey, and it's really useful in looking at the different income levels and their cost burden. Extremely low income means you're making 30% of the area median income, so we're really talking about very low and low earners. 84% of extremely low-income households are cost burdened, meaning that they are spending more than 30% of their income on rent and bills. And 69% of extremely low-income households spend over 50% of their income, meaning they're severely cost burdened. And I think it's helpful to think about who these extremely low-income households are. 30% are in the labor force, 30% are people with disabilities, and 17% are seniors. So we're really looking at three-quarters of extremely low-income households in Alaska are the ones who are most affected by rental increases, and they are working, they are disabled, or they are elderly. And if we dive into that even deeper, 13% of extremely low-income renter households include a single adult caregiver. That could be a single parent or somebody taking care of an elderly family member. And about half of those are also working 20 hours per week outside the home. And 10% of those extremely low-income renter households are in school, meaning they're students. And again, about half of them, 47%, are also working. So these are students who are working, these are single parents who are working, and these are the households that are most impacted by rental increases. There was a great question about if somebody's given notice, can they even find another unit? And frankly, there's a dearth of units across all income levels across the entire state. But that 90-day window allows them to engage with HUD grantee recipients to look at stabilization, to look at rapid rehousing, which is like temporary financial assistance. And there's a lot of amazing things that can be done within the community just to keep people in the houses that they're in and avoid having to have children or elderly or disabled people move. And so that is why we support this effort, and happy to answer any questions if there are any.
Okay, thank you. Next we have Taria Ware. Sorry if I said that wrong. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Taria Ware with the Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness. Our mission is to provide dynamic leadership and to unite Anchorage in making homelessness rare, brief, and one time. And we support HB 262. We agree with the statistics that were given earlier or previously. And in Anchorage, 40% rent hikes have been seen. And one of the things that I like to think about is if one of our mortgages, most of us probably pay a mortgage, if your mortgage had increased by 40%, what kind of impact would that have on your family? So when we're doing surveys and we're talking to people experiencing homelessness, we are asking them, and most recently in our PIT count, which is our point in time count that has to be done in January, we are asking, what is the primary cause of your homelessness? And the primary cause was housing insecurity. Of course, over the next couple of months, we will do a deep dive and gather more data, because that is what we would like to present, is more data and more research. But that was just one snippet in time of what we are hearing from people. Also, when you're looking at folks who are asking for prevention funding, those folks are saying that there are a percentage that are saying it's because something tragic happened, either a medical issue or a loss of a job. But the other part is that the rent has increased and that they can no longer afford the rent for the unit that they had been staying in. So when we're looking in Anchorage of how does that affect, you know, our homeless prevention and response system, how does that affect our community and our neighbors? We're looking at how that affects our shelter system. How does that affect people that are living outside? And it does affect those numbers if people cannot afford to pay their rent. The difference in 60 days is tremendous. It's time for someone to figure out how they can maybe pay that increase in rent. Time to figure out, can they get a security deposit, a first month's rent, a storage unit? Can they pay for the gas and the many application fees that they're going to have to fill out to discover if they can actually be qualified for a place to rent, because their income might be different. So when we are looking at that extra 60 days, and it's just 60 days, right? It also gives us as service providers, well, not us, we're not doing service providers, I'm sorry. It gives service providers a chance to actually step in and help that family or that individual to find somewhere else so they're not ending up in a shelter. We appreciate your time. We did write a letter of support. We encourage you to read that, and thank you.
Okay, thank you. We will set House Bill 262 aside. Thank you to Representative Joseph and staff. And next up, we have House Bill 218 from Representative Sadler. We'll take a brief at ease so Representative Sadler can approach the committee. A record, and let the record reflect that Representative Ruffridge joined us at 4:22 p.m. Representative Sadler, would you please put your name on the record and begin your presentation on House Bill 218. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Dan Sadler, House District 24, Chugiak River, Birchwood, Peters Creek. I can talk fast. I can talk quick. I'm pleased to bring forward House Bill 218, Firefighters Workers' Compensation Requirements, to the committee. The legislature has established an existing law, and actually in an update just 2 years ago, that it has a desire to make sure that firefighters are covered by workers' compensation coverage for illnesses presumably caused by the hazards they encounter on duty. And these specific illnesses include respiratory disease, cardiovascular events, and several different types of cancer. Now, this Bill 218 respects that policy, but makes a few minor adjustments to the qualifications and requirements so that firefighters can get that coverage, but without imposing undue and unnecessary burdens on them or the departments where they work. Current law says that in order to qualify for this disability coverage for these specific illnesses, firefighters must get an initial qualified medical assessment. They must also then get one annual physical exam every year for 7 years. These are, of course, to establish that the firefighter was not exhibiting symptoms of those diseases before starting work or in their first 7 years of service. Now, if the firefighter hasn't worked for 7 years, or if they miss even 1 year's physical exam, then they can't access those benefits for a disability presumably brought on by the exposure to smoke, fumes, and toxic substances in fires. House Bill 218 would change that statute so the firefighters can qualify for the presumption of coverage if for these diseases if several conditions. They had a physical exam upon certification. They had an exam upon their initial hiring as a firefighter. They had 3 years of service, and they've had at least one physical exam every year. Every 5 years. And they must also get an exam at the end of their career, exit exam, if you will. Another benefit of the bill is that it eases the financial burden on the firefighters or their employing departments. Often department will bear the cost of a physical exam for these members, and which can reach upwards of $1,000 to $1,500. Firefighters who are at professional or paid departments may have their evaluations covered by the health insurance. By mandating fewer annual exams, HB 218 is going to reduce the financial burden on departments so they can redirect more of their scarce resources towards fighting fires and saving lives. I'd like to have my intern, Adonis Bussard, run through the sectional analysis. Then I believe we have invited testimony from the Director of Workers' Compensation, Chuck Collins, and the Assistant Chief of Volunteer Fire Department, the Chugiak Volunteer Fire and Rescue Department, John Delacroix, available for questions. So with that, I'd like to ask Mr. Bussard to read through the sectional analysis, if I may.
Thank you. Good afternoon, through the chair. And for the record, my name is Adonis Bussard, staff to Representative Sadler. This is the sectional analysis for House Bill 218, Version B. Section 1, which covers page 1, lines 4 through 14, and page 2, lines 1 through 30, amends Alaska Statute 2330.121B3 to apply Alaska Statute 2330.121B1, the presumption that a claim for compensation for disability as a result of the certain diseases is within the provisions of this chapter to firefighters who have served in the state for at least 3 years instead of 7. Section 1 also amends Alaska Statute 2330.121B3A by updating the medical examination requirements for firefighters to qualify for disability benefits. Currently, statute requires firefighters to get an initial exam and then one each year for 7 years to qualify for the benefits. Section 1 amends those provisions to require qualified medical exams upon certification as a firefighter, initial hiring, and once every 5 years of employment as a firefighter. Section 1 further amends Alaska Statute 2330.121B3A by adding a final requirement that firefighters receive a medical examination within 1 year of terminating service as a firefighter to qualify for disability benefits related to the diseases listed in Alaska Statute 2330.121B1. Those diseases are respiratory disease, cardiovascular events within 72 hours of exposure, primary brain cancer, malignant melanoma, leukemia, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, bladder cancer, ureter cancer, kidney cancer, prostate cancer, and breast cancer. Section 2 on page 2, line 31, provides an immediate effective date. That concludes the sectional analysis for House Bill 218, Version B.
Okay, would you like to move on to invited testimony?
Yes, please.
Okay, looks like we have John Della Croce. Sorry if I mispronounced that. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. For the record, my name is John Delacroce with the Chugiak Volunteer Fire Department. Thank you for inviting me to testify. While presumptive health is a valuable benefit as it currently is, it does have limited accessibility due to the cost of the medical exams. So even the Chugiak Volunteer Fire Department, which we consider ourselves to be one of the larger volunteer departments in the state, we at current form can't afford to give everyone a medical exam every 7 years, and feel that by reducing it to once every 5 years is more palatable to go and search for funding to go ahead and do these medical exams. Also, by reducing the threshold to serve at least 3 years, if we were to snapshot our current membership makeup, that would increase the availability for this benefit to 64% of our firefighters. And so that I feel that would be a good coverage of our firefighters that are putting themselves in danger with these toxins. So with that, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, does the department currently have to carry workers' compensation insurance for firefighters?
Through the chair, yes, we do have current workers' compensation and insurance. We are, you know, an employer, just like, you know, any other employer would be. And so we do, if you were to get hurt on the job currently, it would be covered under workers' comp. I think it's important to note that what this bill covers even in its current form, is somebody that leaves or terminates. So if somebody leaves service and develops cancer within 60 months of leaving, then it's presumed that that was born out of the job hazards.
Thank you. Follow-up? Mm-hmm. And do you know whether your department has experienced increases in the workers' compensation rate coverages, or are there any statistics that might let us know what the change in workers' compensation coverage has been with these presumptions that disease was caused on the job?
Through the chair, I am not prepared to talk about any change in insurance costs, just for lack of being prepared to speak to that. I can certainly follow up. But I do know that insurance is one of our largest costs annually.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler, I see on here I have a Chuck Collins, Director of Workers' Compensation. Is that invited testimony for you or no?
I believe he's here to answer questions. Okay. I don't know if he has anything you would want to add. I'm not sure if you can actually answer that question. I'm not sure if he can.
Representative Prox?
Mr. Collins might be able to answer that question.
Well, Mr. Collins?
I'd like to put him on the spot anyway.
Okay. So, yeah.
For the record, Charles Collins, Workers' Compensation of Alaska, Department of Labor. That's an interesting thought, Representative Prax, through the chair. I actually haven't spoke to the actuary. That would be NCCI usually pulls those numbers, and we could certainly task them with that to see. We with the changes recently to the presumptions, I think, as I recall, the forecast was it would raise the cost of the entire workers' compensation 0.2%. We could see whether or not we could narrow that down to just the like volunteer fire departments, municipalities, you know, the major fire departments, to see if we could come up with something. I can't guarantee that, but I certainly could ask. Mm-hmm. That's about the best I can do on that.
Okay. And then to follow up. Thank you. Through the chair, I'm a little bit surprised that we deal with firefighters in particular on just a presumption that something was caused by them being on the job. But I worked in an industry where maybe it was OSHA, I don't know. But are there any rules established to reduce the exposure or prevent the exposure?
Through the chair, Representative Prox. So workers' compensation wouldn't be involved in that, since we're kind of at the end of that process. There are, I can tell you, because we quite often on our board, we have had a representative from the fire department, believe it or not, on our board, and is quite knowledgeable about the systems as he works for the municipality of Anchorage. It's quite intense, the decontamination at the end of any major fire that they go through, and this is a matter of record, and it's a process that the fire departments have used as a best practice. I can't say whether or not there's any law around that because I'm just not that familiar with it. So.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Representative Sadler?
Actually, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if Chief Delacroix might be able to answer that question, or at least to explain what the departments do to try and minimize illnesses and therefore workers' comp claims.
Mr. Delacroix, have you heard the question?
Yes, through the chair. You know, health and safety is something that is always on our forefront. We have air, you know, self-contained breathing apparatus that we wear anytime we're in smoke. And so we have policies and procedures in place to limit our exposures. But there is always that risk. You know, we just had a fire last Thursday, and so we're going now through and decontaminating our gear and washing it and, you know, doing the fire investigation and just the unintentional exposures, if you will. You know, we do a really good job with our policies and procedures to limit exposures, but unfortunately, there's still some risk involved, and so I think that's what the protection of the bill gives us, a little peace of mind.
Okay, thank you. All right. Well, we are going to set this bill aside for a future date where we'll notice. Where we'll notice public testimony and probably talk to the committee about setting an amendment deadline. Thank you very much, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That concludes our business today. Seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 5:05 p.m.